Welcome to MacGuffin Men. I'm Alex, and with me, as usual, is James. Check out our website, themacguffinmen.com, for various podcasts. We most recently talked about Spotlight. Spotlight. And a little bit about the Oscars. And previous to that, we talked about Hail Caesar and 13 Hours, The Secret Soldiers of Benghazi. Also follow us on Twitter. Subscribe to us on iTunes. We're only a few weeks away from our American Crime Story podcast that will 100% have to happen. Whether or not James is a part of it is to be decided, but it will happen, even if it's just me monologuing about it. Keep up with whatever we're doing on Twitter and iTunes. So we'll just get right to it.
Welcome to the MacGuffin Men. And now, here are Alex and James.
All right, James.
Yes.
We are talking about
Anomalisa.
There we go. Teamwork. We finish each other's sentences.
That's right. At long last, another Charlie Kaufman production to talk about.
Yeah, exactly. And I mean, we took our time with it, but I think it's because it probably just never played in theaters around you, right?
Correct.
Yeah. I assumed it would get there eventually, but it's a bummer for you.
Yes. Well, yeah, I mean, it was 2008 was Synecdoche, New York. Which Charlie Kaufman wrote and directed. And just in reading some interviews about him recently in preparation for this, that kind of seemed to slow his career down a little bit.
Mm-hmm. Well, and he didn't want to direct Synecdoche, New York either. Like he wanted Spike Jonze to do it. And Spike Jonze, we've talked about the very troubled production of Where the Wild Things Are, but it kind of kept him out of being able to direct Synecdoche.
Mm-hmm. And Charlie Kaufman still seems very, very proud of that movie and the way that it turned out. Just the only thing that really bothered him about it not being received that well is that people are a bit more apprehensive to kind of move forward with some of the projects that he'd like to do.
Mm-hmm.
And, see Synecdoche, New York, or I guess anything else in Charlie Kaufman's career to see that he's a rather uncompromising gentleman.
Mm-hmm.
And this is 8 years after the, or I guess it's 7 years after the fact, he was doing a project that he wanted to do, kind of on the terms that he wanted to do it. And that's Anomalisa, which he wrote and I guess co-directed.
Yeah.
Duke Johnson is credited as co-director.
Exactly.
My understanding is that is more just the kind of nuts and bolts of the way they chose to animate this, and that Duke Johnson is very talented that it came to that. Is that kind of your understanding of it as well?
Yeah, like Duke Johnson specializes in stop motion, and it's, for people listening to this podcast, so Alistair, he's most famous for doing the Community Claymation episode. He directed that. And, he's worked on Moral Oral, which is Scott Adsit and Dino Stamatopoulos' show that I never watched, but heard good things about. He's just a stop motion specialist. But judging by the way that Charlie Kaufman has talked about Duke Johnson, it was more than just he's the guy that knows things about the technology. It's that there was an actual creative collaboration there,
Yeah. I don't mean to kind of undermine his contribution to it, but this was written by Charlie Kaufman, 10 years before it was a movie.
Yeah.
And was originally what was termed a sound play, which was played in the Theater of the New Ear.
Mm-hmm.
And did you read much about the play?
Just that it was basically like just all sound. And that's part of the reason why Tom Noonan played so many characters, right? And I think they weren't even like the actors, performers weren't even lit, right?
Yeah. And it was just those three actors. Tom Noonan, who you mentioned, who plays every voice in this movie except two characters. David Toulis?
Your guess is as good as mine.
Okay. And
that does sound like the way Michael Stone would pronounce that name.
Yeah, so. That's right. And Jennifer Jason Leigh.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, as you said, it was really not a visual performance. It was a sound play. It was them you know, performing the lines, but not so much of the action, and Foley artists on stage doing the, you know, the sounds of footsteps and doors and things like that. Mm-hmm. And I guess Charlie Kaufman was initially kind of reluctant to turn this into a film at all, animated or otherwise. And there was something about kind of that disconnect of not having the actors and performers, you know, acted out in a kind of a typical way. And so then this went from the idea of doing a short film around 40 minutes to, you know, a 90 minute film, which eventually we got.
Yeah. Yeah. And I mean, it's like 82 minutes of content. And I only specify that because getting an 83rd minute is just so much extra work, you know, like it's the timeline matters, you know, and it's 82 minutes before end credits is what I mean.
Do you mean that just from the stop motion kind
yeah,
of?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. That's, I mean, you know this better than I would, but extremely tedious process from what I'm understanding.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, and especially like if you were to watch this movie just focusing on some of the animation choices they make, it's crazy how difficult this movie is to make, you know, like even if you just look at the bar scene, the first bar scene where Michael is meeting with Bella, there are so many people in the background and walking past the foreground that do not need to be there at all. Like I think they augment the point of the movie, but are just so much effort, like, cause you have to move all of these people and everything. And I don't know. I don't know what the effects, what they did in, I guess this whole movie is done in post, but in post, you know?
Yeah.
So I don't even know if they were actually doing a lot of those, or if a couple of the like really far back ones were added in computers or whatnot. But it's just staggering how many choices they make that just to add things into the scene that aren't necessarily related to the scene. It's just so difficult. And they had a goal. Each animator had a goal of getting 48 frames of film a day, which is 2 seconds. And it sounds like nobody ever hit their goal, you know?
Yeah, from what I understand, it was about 12 frames a day is what they kind of felt that they averaged, which, as you said, is what, about half a second?
Yes, it is half a second, yeah, which is crazy. Yeah. And like, I mean, you know this, but I did like not a stop motion with figures music video, but stop motion with people music video. And I think we did 30 hours and got 3 minutes of content, but we only shot 12 frames a second. And these guys are doing 24, you know? And I don't know. It's just so staggering how difficult stop motion is and how tedious it is. And I mean, there's a really good illustration of it with when Ben Wyatt quits his job in Parks and Rec, and he makes his Tuesday movie or whatever, and it's he works on it for like a week, and he has like a second of a guy standing out of bed, you know. And that's kind of how it is, you know.
Yeah, yeah. And I mean, that stop motion altogether, and then this for Anomalisa in particular, the nature of the puppets, I mean, they were 3D printed. I wouldn't even know if puppet's the right word, but we'll say the characters in this movie. They had several, you know, foreheads and eyes and, you know, jaw configurations that they could swap out to make these facial expressions and to make these characters as expressive as they are.
Yeah.
And so that's, you know, another step to make this so tedious and time consuming.
Yeah. And one thing that you can really see in this movie, like if you watch Michael's forehead, you know, throughout the movie, like he just from frame to frame, it'll change. And which is just crazy. Like it's crazy that they did that. And it's so difficult and it's so impressive. And like you said, the characters in this movie are beautiful. And then also the number of absolutely infinitesimal animations that are done and what they had to do to pull those off is really impressive.
Yeah, and it's, I mean, just the, I mean, to talk about the puppets, the characters, figures, yeah, just so expressive. And that's it, I mean, it's so important because this is a character driven movie. I mean, we're talking so much about just the visual appearance of it, but it's not a big, you know, splashy spectacle of a movie. You know, they certainly visually it's very impressive what they've done, and I mean, I think aesthetically it's a very pleasing movie to look at. In a way, is I mean, it's often thematically very kind of uncomfortable. Mm-hmm. But I mean, it does look great. But if this weren't an animated movie, this would kind of just be a quiet little character piece of a movie, right?
Yeah, yeah, yeah,
yeah. And that's
it's lost in translation, you know.
Yeah, well, yeah. I saw that. I saw someone, David Calhoun, Time Out magazine, said this is what might happen if Charlie Kaufman got his hands on Up in the Air or Lost in Translation. Mm-hmm. And yeah, that's accurate, right?
I think so. Certainly more so with Lost in Translation, just because Up in the Air, there's more movement involved, there's more travel. Whereas this is just one place for the most part.
Yeah, that's true.
Yeah.
And I mean, and related to that, one of the things I really do enjoy about this movie, which overall I unsurprisingly did enjoy quite a lot, is just how long some of these scenes are and just how we kind of stick with Michael. I mean, this whole movie takes place over, I'm guessing, for the most part, 24 hours. I mean, he's only in Cincinnati for a day. We get him back at home in Los Angeles at the end of the film. But for the most part, this movie's, you know, within less than a day, right?
I think it's probably say it's a Monday and Tuesday. I think we're probably starting on the morning of a Monday and ending at the night of Tuesday, you know, just because there's a lot that does happen. Yeah,
yeah, that's true. Yeah. I just really enjoyed, as I said, how long we stick with him. I mean, just the whole process of a taxi ride and very few cuts and the whole process of checking into a hotel and mm-hmm. being walked right into your room. And that is important just for, you know, a few reasons. It adds to the realism of this movie, which, you know, despite a dream sequence and just the kind of odd way that this film is presented, it's very realistic and I think grounded in, you know, real human experience.
Yeah, for sure. And especially like as far as things that happen in this movie compared to other Charlie Kaufman movies, it's weird to say that his stop motion animated movie is his most realistic film to date, but it is.
Yeah. Yeah, no, absolutely. And I mean, there's things like
there's no Caden building a new world.
Yeah. Yeah. Just that's so much of what's inside of Charlie Kaufman's career, which is, you know, as you said, it sounds very counterintuitive because of how expansive and grand some of these some of the things he's done are, and how inventive and imaginative some of the things, some of the projects he's been responsible for are. It's just kind of about life and being an adult and kind of going through the motions and all these kinds of things. And it's just so, that's so front and center in this movie, just having those little conversations with a bellhop or a taxi driver or everything it takes. You know, those awkward moments near the end of a date or an outing with a friend or something like that. That's kind of where this movie really lives, I feel.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, for sure. And there's a lot of, I don't want to say like dead air in this movie, but the not boring equivalent of the term dead air, you know?
Yeah. No, absolutely. Like even just, I think one of the times that really hit me is just when he and the bellhop are walking down the hallway to get to his room for the first time. Mm-hmm. And I mean, visually, there's kind of a lot of space as well. Mm-hmm. It's kind of got this large hallway and then framed right in the center. But yeah,
it's just the Matrix Reloaded hallway.
Oh, yeah.
Just the color scheme's different.
Yeah, just that, you know, as you said, that kind of very realistic dead air, but it's kind of the space to breathe. And I just think there's a lot of things in this movie to think about, and it gives you enough time to do that. Mm-hmm. What did you think of this movie overall?
I like it for sure. I would say, I mean, we've talked a bit about this on the last couple of podcasts about me not being able to remove myself from things I already know about the people that have made these products. And that certainly hindered it. I was talking to somebody last night and I said, I feel like I would have absolutely adored this movie if Charlie Kaufman's name wasn't attached to it.
Why is that?
Just because, like, when you see a Charlie Kaufman movie, especially after Synecdoche, New York, where they do so much in live action and you know it's stop motion, I was expecting, like, I suppose more dream sequence, you know, more faces falling off and all that stuff. Whereas this is just, it's like you said, it's a very realistic movie for the most part. And I think it was just sort of a conversation of expectations going on in my head. And I certainly liked it. I enjoyed the movie. I laughed a bunch and enjoy some of the things that it's about. Love the sound design specifically. But there's just something about it that doesn't connect with me in a way that I would say some of his other movies have.
Yeah, and I guess I think we probably would have talked about this with Christopher Nolan's career as well, of it just getting each film kind of getting bigger and bigger. And I mean, that comes with just budget and notoriety and things like that, being able to handle some of these bigger ideas. But you know, after Interstellar, after hundreds of years and you know, a whole universe, how do you get bigger than this? And I think after Synecdoche, New York, which was so massive and expansive, it's hard to top that. And yeah, the approach of hearing the stop motion animation thing could set you up for something very crazy and wild. Mm-hmm. And it's, you know, just this small little kind of relationship depression movie.
And so what you're saying is that Dunkirk is going to be Christopher Nolan's Anomalisa. Just want to be on record for that. Yes, I agree. Yeah.
Okay. Do you think it was a mistake to do this as animation?
No. No.
Okay.
Because it's gorgeous. It's beautiful. I don't want to talk anybody out of making something this pretty.
Yeah, and we talked about the...
Oh, sorry, the point I wanted to make, the Charlie Kaufman thing that I think I can distill down to, as far as the movies that he's been a part of that I've loved, so Adaptation, Eternal Sunshine, and Synecdoche, when you're done with those movies for the first time, you have... Oh, and being John Malkovich... You kind of don't. You have to put yourself back together a little bit, you know, especially Synecdoche, New York.
Because New York's brutal.
Like, one, it's a shattering movie when you know what it's about, and two, the first time through it, you kind of know what it's about, but you really you can't piece it together, you know. And it's what you with Anomalisa. It's what you said. Like, I didn't have to watch this movie a second time. I did because I enjoyed watching it the first time. But it's like you said, there's enough space in there that you can figure your stuff out while it's happening. And by the time you hit directed by Charlie Kaufman and Duke Johnson, you kind of have a read on the movie. And my reading hasn't changed much since that. You know?
No. Okay.
Since that first viewing in September or whatever.
Right.
Yeah.
So what are some of your readings? I mean, some of the not completely surface stuff that you're able to take away on thinking about this movie?
Well, the main thing is, I mean, that Michael feels he's more important than everybody. You know, like, that's why all the faces and all the voices are the same. It's just that he is the only standout in this world, right? And that's something that runs through the whole movie. I like the that we can still see the cracks in the various pieces of specifically the face of the characters. Like this guy is ready to fall apart at any point, as are every other person in the world. And the fact that there are a lot of other people in this world, like I said, it's this real sort of dense sort of world in any place where there are other characters. Like the movie opens on a black screen with a lot of different conversations happening, you know. It's like
a lot of Noonan on Noonan conversations. Yeah, exactly. Going on.
Like this is what the world is. It's people talking, and they're not all Michael. Like, things are happening outside of Michael, and the bar is another good example of that, especially the first time. And it's sort of, I like that idea of somebody that kind of views himself, whether he knows it or not, as the center of the world or of his world, trying to come to grips with the fact that quote unquote, every person has a life, you know, or every human has had a day or whatever. Yeah. You know?
Yeah. And so why is Lisa different?
I think what Michael sees in Lisa at the beginning, I don't know what grabs him or about her initially, because I mean, her introduction to the movie is he hears her while he is about to take off the bottom part of his face while looking at himself in the mirror, you know?
Yeah.
And something about her voice stops him from doing that, and he has to rush out and try and find her.
Yeah, just that it's not the other Tom Noonan. Like, it's not that everyone else is just, you know, another person that's not Michael. It's everyone in the world is, you know, capital N, not Michael. Like, it's there's just, they're all the same.
Yeah, exactly. And then in talking to her, like, throughout their conversations that night, he is like, you know, he has his own problems in his head. He has things that he wonders if he should regret and all this stuff, but he still feels pretty like okay with, like, at least his level of intelligence and in general, like, where, how other people see him, for the most part.
Yeah,
exactly. He feels like he's a success, right? And Anomalisa has, or Lisa, sorry, has a lot of, she has a lot more self-confidence issues, you know? And I feel like Michael sort of, that's kind of what attracts him to her. And it might even just be something as, unfortunately, self-centered as, like, him thinking that he can make her world better, which I think is probably part of it. But I think that is also part of the attraction, right? Like, you specifically see him want to have a nightcap with Lisa instead of Emily, where Emily is far and away the more confident of the two, you know?
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah,
yeah, and I think from a more just kind of the relationship standpoint in general, I mean, I think this movie, like, I guess all of Charlie Kaufman movies, if I run through them quickly in my head, there's just a very strong theme of romantic relationships. Mm-hmm. I mean, relationships in general and family relationships are present too. But the romantic relationship, I think, is, you know, just very present in all his movies. And just the way that, you know, it's he thinks everybody else is, you know, one person, or you know, kind of this blob of separate people, but you know, kind of the same entity. Mm-hmm. And then we have Lisa, who's something else and who is her own person. And I think it's that people, like, you know, characters often in a Charlie Kaufman movie, and perhaps himself, it's kind of this me versus the world mentality. There's kind of a not even in a competitive sense, but just that the world and everybody in it is a threat, or, you know, something to be overcome, something to be challenged and conquered. And again, not in a competitive kind of way, but just to stay alive, you know, just to self-actualization in the face of this much bigger thing outside of you. And you know, he sees Lisa for who she is. He sees her as an individual, and it's that way. And, you know, a really good relationship where it's not you versus the world anymore. It's at least us versus everybody else. And that there's someone that he seems to relate to. I think probably, as you said, for maybe not the right reasons, or maybe not for 100% the correct reasons in this one, mm-hmm. but, you know, kind of has someone on his side, someone else who is separate from the big bad world outside of yourself. And I think that that's a pretty sweet notion. I think, you know, as we've said, maybe he isn't the most healthy person to be getting into things like this, but I think that's there. And I think that's something that works so well with the way that this movie was done, with the puppets, with the animation like this, is to, I just don't know how you do that in another movie without, you know, doing a John Malkovich dream sequence where, you know, he plays everybody and just has different hair and clothing depending on gender and age. Mm-hmm. And I think that was done really well here. And I love all the stuff of Tom Noonan's voice being everybody else in this movie. Mm-hmm. I think those conversations where they're, you know, you hear the same person's voice cutting off that voice, or, you know, overlap conversations with one voice. I think it was just a really cool trick. And the, you know, just going up to that notion of, you know, you versus the rest of the world, I think that's a really cool, I think they did a really good job of kind of achieving that mentality through the voice and the animation like that.
Yeah, I agree. I would also be very curious to know, like, if you were to string all of Tom Noonan's lines together, like one by one, how long his voice plays in this movie, or like, yeah, you know, how long his lines in this movie take to listen to one by one.
Yeah. Well, and it's, it goes throughout the whole credit sequence as well.
Yeah. Oh yeah, for sure.
Not short.
Yeah, it's like an 8 minute long credit sequence. Yeah. And which, I for think, like, if this movie was shot like Lost in Translation, it's about 3 minutes, you know.
Right. Well, I think Tom Noonan's voice is just absolutely perfect for what they had him doing too, right?
Oh yeah, for sure.
Yeah, it's got that kind of, it's polite enough but not warm in any way. And I mean, I know some of this is his natural voice and some of this is the performance and him, you know, wanting to achieve those kinds of things, but it's, you know, it's cordial but not friendly. It's, I don't know, I think it's just a combination of a great voice and a great performance, and I think it adds a lot to the movie as well.
I concur.
Good.
Yeah,
so glad that you do.
Speaking of good voices and good performances, I very much enjoyed David Tulis's voice as well.
Yeah.
Oh yeah, it's great. And it sounds like it fits so perfectly with because that, like, that's not exactly what he naturally sounds like. There, he sounds kind of like that, but he, you know, he's putting on a Michael Stone voice to an extent. But it just fits so perfectly with the type of character Michael Stone is supposed to be. Like, he feels like somebody who strongly believes he's right a lot of the time, you know. And and it's not even just the accent so much as it is, like, the weight of the voice, if you will. He just sort of feels like somebody that feels correct pretty much all the time. Unless he's very obviously questioning things at a podium, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, and I do think part of that is the accent, too. Just that him being such an outsider, or feeling as though such an outsider in this movie. And I think also feeling just better than most people in this movie too. I think that accent helps, and his voice in general, I think I agree, it fits very well.
Yeah. And I don't know, I feel like it's, yeah, I don't know. Well, okay, so how do we feel about, should we just jump to the, like, the morning after, when they're like, when he's, Lisa starts to lose her appeal a little bit, or?
Yeah, sure.
Okay, because, like, I mean, when she starts to lose her voice and start to sound like Tom Noonan, and when I say lose her voice, I don't mean struggle to speak, but, like,
yeah,
it's basically the morning after. Like, he has his nightmare that, quote unquote, or wakes him up, and that doesn't actually, and then he wakes up from the actual nightmare, and they have breakfast together. And pretty much as soon as Lisa agrees to join Michael in his idea of they should be together, basically, it's pretty much immediately that he starts to see flaws in her, you know? And
yeah,
we get that close up of her eating her scrambled eggs, the most normal kind of eggs, and talking about how they're perfectly scrambled, which I found very funny. And he starts to see that the way she chews or eats her food while talking, and he doesn't like that. And, then she starts to sound like Tom Noonan, like she's kind of joining the rest of the people. And I found that really interesting as far as, like, Michael can never truly like anybody that is willing to get close to him, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
And that's a lot of what I like about the core of this movie, is that it's Michael realizing that he's kind of a bit of a shit, you know?
Yeah, so, I mean, how do we explain his relationship with Lisa? I mean, part of it, I think, is just the it's a burn that's on her face, right? That gets said?
Yeah, or, I believe
yeah.
so.
Yeah. I mean, it seems like that is kind of the one thing that makes her stand out. And I mean, in their conversations, you know, as their relationship moves forward, you know, she seems interesting and she seems nice and a good singer, more Cyndi Lauper in this movie than I anticipated.
It could have been worse, Jim.
Yeah, no, for sure. Chewy. Well, it's just the fact that, I mean, it's not as though she's, unlovable by any means, but it's the fact that he can hear her voice before they've ever, you know, talked to each other.
Yeah,
he hears her voice in the hallway as actually her voice. So, I mean, there's something there. And I think part of the burn is that he sees, you know, this kind of imperfection, the way that everyone has the exact same, you know, smooth face of these puppets, that, you know, and hers is different. And there's something unique that he kind of latches onto, and, you know, they develop a relationship. And yeah, as you said, it kind of reaches a point where it looks like it's just going to be the same relationship he's had with everybody else. Mm-hmm. Once she's on board, you know, when they talk about whether she's going to stay here or move to LA, once it starts becoming real and you get into those logistics of working on a relationship, her uniqueness fades, and, you know, she loses that proper voice of hers and goes into the same Tom Noonan voice that the rest of the world has. Mm-hmm. And yeah, I wanted to get your opinion on, you know, not just why she was different to begin with and the nature of his attraction to her, but why that fades as well.
Well, part of the thing that I think Michael is struggling with is that, and like the fact that he is alone in this hotel room just kind of amplifies these things. Like, one, he's in a city where his ex lives, ex being Bella, who he meets up with at the bar early on in the film. And I think that after that goes so poorly, that kind of exacerbates things as far as loneliness goes. And I think a lot of what Michael is dealing with in this movie is regret, specifically, or wondering if he should regret things more. And that's, I think, whenever somebody calls an ex, especially when they are the one that ended things, there is an element of regret there. And I think that's what Michael was sort of dealing with towards the beginning, was maybe feeling a little bit bad that he left Bella the way that he did, and maybe feeling bad that he left Bella in general, and maybe that he should have started a family with her instead of the woman whose name I cannot recall, but who he didn't end up marrying.
Tom Noonan.
Yeah, well, thanks. Yeah, and I think that sort of exacerbates things, as I said, but I have nothing for hearing Lisa walking by. You know, it's just...
Yeah.
I think it's just something to pull him out of his loneliness, and something just sort of catches his ear perfectly, and it's just something that can't be explained, and that's where it goes. I also think part of his attraction to Lisa can be attributed to alcohol.
yep.
Because he drinks a lot before he meets Lisa, and then drinks more, you know, and he certainly seems like a high-functioning alcoholic, but... you know, everybody's going to get got at some point. And I think that's part of the attraction to Lisa, is that he, I mean, we see him have at least three martinis and two drinks in his bedroom, you know,
yeah.
Over probably like 5 hours, but still that adds up. And yeah, and I think that sort of allows him to ignore some of the things that he finds annoying in the morning, you know?
Yeah.
And so that's part of the attraction. And as far as him, it's kind of it's weird to make this comparison, but it's kind of the Jeannie Steinfeld thing, right? It's the, once he realizes that she's kind of, well, it's not the same, but like willing to be around him enough, she just can't, he just hates himself so much that he can't deal with anybody that actually likes him, you know?
Yeah. And it, as I said, once they kind of start figuring out how this is all going to work, it all that predictability, all the tedium and the sameness and the minutiae that Charlie Kaufman explores in all his movies, but I think this is leans on that kind of the most, just the way that everybody blurs together. everyone has the same conversations about weather and, you know, how his flight was and things like that. Yeah, it's all that kind of starts showing up in Lisa. You know, once I think he kind of, because I mean, this sounds bad too, but I do think part of it is a little bit of pity, the way that he does treat her at first. Mm-hmm. As I said, I think she has a fine personality and seems to be unique and interesting and likes to have fun and things like that. But I think eventually he kind of feels like he's doing something good by spending his time with this person. Mm-hmm. And, you know, just the fact that he's
blessing her with his existence, basically.
Yeah. And even if there was, regardless of who Lisa was, just that, you know, within his field, he's somewhat of a celebrity. You know, they all know who he was. A surprising amount of people in the restaurant, I thought, knew who he was, but mm-hmm. I'm not certain exactly what celebrity to compare him to.
Yeah. Well, I think part of that is that I think the majority of the people in this hotel
are there
that night are there for the conference. And you get that a lot when people are going to a conference that's taking place in a hotel. There tends to be a lot, or at least I think it's taking place in the hotel. There seem to be a lot of people from that conference in that same hotel.
Yeah. And so he kind of, I think he feels good about himself. And as you said, the way he goes to see Bella and kind of has regrets, I think he feels bad. That relationship seemed to end. I mean, he put an end to it, but it seems like he put an end to it in a pretty unfair way where I think he kind of walked away from it. And never.
Yeah, really it was very swift.
Yeah, it never kind of gave her a chance to understand why it was ending or try to fix it or anything like that. And so I think when he kind of feels bad about that, he sees that he's hurt her and in a way that I don't think he's ever going to condone for, even if he wanted to. And so then he kind of moves on to Lisa and I think he does feel good about himself. And then, you know, the next morning kicks in and you realize, you know, one, you're sober. Two, you're kind of realizing that this is likely going to turn out the way other things turned out mm-hmm. because you haven't changed at all. And that's when she kind of starts slipping into to that voice and just becoming one more person like everybody else. And I think there's the patterns in this movie, I think, are very important. You know, the way that everyone he deals with, you know, all the kind of customer service people are just going through their spiel, you know, the way that the bellhop talks to him and the man at the front desk and the taxi driver. And I think it's important that he's this kind of customer service guru, I guess. I think that ties on so well with what he's suffering from of everybody appearing to be the same person because, you know, in those jobs, you handle the customer. You know, it's kind of this faceless, nameless person with no context. It's, you know, the customer is the person that he's concerned with. And, you know, I think it's interesting that he's so often misunderstood in this movie. Mm-hmm. I mean, he's misheard or, you know, something is taken the wrong way. And I think that's really fascinating because that's his job is that he's a public speaker, an author, and he communicates to these people and he teaches them how to communicate with other people. And that's such a difficulty for him. And, you know, he's making his money in this field where you have pretty surface conversations with people, you know, depending on what type of customer service, but it's all kind of helping people you don't know, treating them politely, but without crossing any lines. And I think that's, you know, interesting thematically that his job lines up so well with the issues that he seems to be having in his romantic relationships.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I also just want to point out the name of his book, which is How May I Help You Help Them, which I really enjoy.
Yeah, it did, man. Charlie Kaufman's jokes. I mean, this is such a bleak movie and you don't get the sense that, okay, it's been pretty drab for a while. Let's plug in a few jokes quickly, then get back to it. I find there's some very, very funny parts in this movie and they all kind of come up pretty organically and then they're fleeting. And I think that adds to the realism of it as well.
Well, yeah, I mean, that's one of the things that people kind of always forget about Charlie Kaufman, just because I mean, I don't think it's the best part of his writing, but I mean, being the second best part of Charlie Kaufman's writing is still about 10 times better than anybody else's. But like, he's a comedy writer, you know? His movies are comedies. They're just, I think more, I suppose mentally complex than Judd Apatow's output, you know?
Yeah.
And
the first 10 minutes of Synecdoche, New York is straight up hilarious.
Yeah. No, I know. We've talked about this, and there's so many funny moments in this movie, like the taxi driver calling the zoo zoo sized, and then seeing the billboard that says it's zoo sized for the zoo, which is incredibly funny.
Taking chili will take an hour.
Yeah, exactly. There's, I mean,
yeah,
and I think, know you and I are certainly understand this, but like, Charlie Kaufman writes comedies and is very funny. Being John Malkovich, I think it's probably the best example. Like, just the line you know, I'm paraphrasing, but there's no room for a puppeteer in this wintry economic climate or whatever. That's so funny.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And he's just the highest class of comedy writer in that we can't even see that he's writing comedies.
Yeah. And especially, I mean, just the beginning of this movie, you know, we have all these voices, you know, as you said, we start on black, we have all these voices. You can't really pick apart a kind of a through line through all these conversations. They're all really muddled together because it's one person's voice over and over. And you know, we get the shot of an airplane through an airplane window, and you're really still kind of just trying to orient yourself and get a feel for what this movie is and what's happening. And there's kind of all this information coming at you, and you're really trying to keep up, just trying to piece it together. And when the guy in the seat next to him says, "Sorry for holding your hand, I'm used to my wife," and then a little bit past he says, "You can let go now."
Yeah.
I think that's a really, really funny joke that creeps up on you. And yeah, I mean, there's good examples of great little jokes all throughout this. And again, I think that's just something that rings true. I mean, I think that there's times where things are such a bummer and so serious. In real life, but then there's just something that is undeniably funny, and even if you can't laugh about it at the time, it's incredible that happened right at that moment too.
Yeah,
right?
I think the Forgetting Sarah Marshall breakup is a good example of that, because Jason Segel has talked about how, because for those that haven't seen the movie in a long time, Jason Segel is getting dumped while he's naked, and he, like, that is something that he said happened to him, and at some point during the conversation, he started to think, "I can't wait for this to be over so I can write it down," you know, like, because this is so funny. And yeah, and I think you're exactly right. And that's just a good example of it.
Yeah. What do you make of the ending where Lisa's friend has a face, a real unique face finally?
I sort of see, well, and Lisa's voice comes back to her as well.
Right. Yeah.
I think that it is kind of a moment of Michael learning something, right? And what he decides to do with that information, you know, is left up to us. But I think one of the things that this movie wants us to think about at the end is that this is a world full of people that all deserve your respect. And there are plenty of shitty people in this world, and there are plenty of dummies in the world, but they're all still humans. They still have a day. They still have a face, whatever. Right. And, Lisa getting further away from Michael is what allows her to get her voice back. Like the fact that she is now away from the person that Michael probably hates the most. Yeah, it's him kind of, cause that is the scene where, you know, it's presented like we're seeing Lisa and Emily driving away, but I would imagine that's just Michael picturing Lisa writing that note more than anything, because it's the only scene in the movie that Michael's not in. So I would assume that it is happening in his head. And so what I think,
he's self-centered like that.
Well, yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
And I just, like, in a movie like this, when there's only one scene with the main character, it would seem weird to sort of change perspective entirely, right? And it's still Michael reading that note. Anyway, doesn't matter. Yeah. And I think what he is getting out of it is that he's starting to realize that other people have value and other people should be respected, right? And that's why Anomalisa is talking about how, or Lisa is talking about the term Anomalisa, how she looked it up and how it means goddess of, what is it again?
Heaven.
Goddess of heaven. And she's like, I like that. Like, not that I think of myself as a goddess or anything, which is kind of the opposite of how Michael has been sort of viewing this world, right? It's that all of these people are the same and they all revolve around him. You know, he could, God is a strong choice of words, but he is still the person at the center of this world.
Yeah.
And as she says that, he said that's the lesson that he kind of takes from her, is that he should be able to see people like Emily's face, you know, and he should be able to see that these people are different. And yeah, and that's what I take away from the movie, is that other people have value, basically.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. No, I think I have a slightly different interpretation of it.
Oh, but who knew a Charlie Kaufman movie would open?
No, it kind of ends in the same place anyway. But I think that is, I think things are over between Lisa and Michael at that point.
Oh, yeah, for sure.
I think that even, I mean, I guess we kind of saw this with Bella, but he's not going to see her like a real person again, even if they never meet or speak to each other. I think things are over between them. And I think that that actually is the first and only time we're seeing something outside of Michael's experience. I think that's a kind of a picture of the world as it actually is. I think Michael is stuck where he is. I think he's never going to divorce his wife the way that he kind of probably suggests he will to a lot of different women in similar circumstances as his relationship with Lisa was. You know, and he's stuck. He's sitting on the bottom step of the stairs, and, you know, people are moving around him. And
well, and sorry to interrupt, but that party, like when he walks into that party, it feels like his wife is having a party to convince him not to kill himself. Like, it's unbelievable how how weirdly dark that party feels.
Well, she's not very nice to him if she's trying to talk him out of suicide.
I'm sorry?
She's not that nice to him. Pretty quick.
Yeah, I don't know. It's just the, like, the feel of the party. It's just so weird to me. Anyway, yeah. Sorry, continue.
No, it's just weird that, like, just because you're stuck in his perspective, this surprise party, and you get that he's probably, you know, kind of famous, probably has people to his parties that he doesn't know or like that much. But to still be stuck in his perspective where they all have the same face, I think really drives that home. But anyway, yeah, I think he's done. He's just, you know, I think sitting on the bottom stair is a good bummer visual to kind of explain his mentality at that point. And Lisa and Emily are moving, you know, they're in a car, and I think that things are still happening with them, and they aren't finished the way that Michael is. I think things are still going to change for them, and they can grow, and they can meet new people and form meaningful relationships and still have some mobility in their life. Whereas Michael's stuck, he is who he is. He's stuck where he is in life. And I think that moment is the first time we're seeing something from someone else's perspective. And I think it's kind of following Lisa's story for even just that one scene. And she's, you know, being nice and writing a nice letter to him. And then we look over at her friend Emily, and she has a face, and she is a whole real, you know, fleshed out person. And Michael's never going to see the world like that. But there are people like Lisa who will and who are, and who are going to inhabit this more vibrant, optimistic world. And Michael's going to walk through that once in a while, but he's going to be stuck in his very depressed, bland, uniform Charlie Kaufman like world.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. No, I don't disagree. I mean,
yeah. Well, but I that's what I mean.
We can each see where the other is coming from. I'm surprised I have the more optimistic reading of this movie than you.
Yeah, that doesn't happen too much.
Although I was last night to the same person I was talking to about this movie, there it is, that I find Charlie Kaufman's movies way more hopeful than other people seem to, and I think that certainly illustrates that, you know.
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah. So yeah, I don't know, I guess we should call it a day there.
Yeah. Oh yeah, yeah. I think
you
so.
Don't have anything else to add?
No, just keep doing what you're doing, Charlie.
Yeah. Well, I mean, that's one of the great things about the fact that this is so old. Like, he wrote this in 2005, 2006. Yeah.
Well, yeah. I mean, I think it was being performed in 2005. So.
Okay. So, I mean, he's got to have a script close to being done, right? Because Synecdoche is out of his head end of 2008. And I don't know. He's got to have something, you know?
Yeah.
And if you look at his most likely next collaborator, Spike Jonze doesn't have a film on the go and is coming off a successful film. So maybe he'll be able to actually get something made.
Yeah. Well, there's the TV show that didn't get picked up.
Oh, yeah. I forgot about that.
He was involved with. It's just... I mean, this was the first R-rated animated feature to get an Oscar nomination. Mm-hmm. It's just, I don't know, part of this is that I was reading about the way China is affecting the film industry in the States and how depressing that whole series scenario is. But this is just like an adult movie. You know what I mean? Like, there could be 10 stories like this that come out every year. It's just they don't really, or they don't get the huge exposure. It's just not superb. I mean, there's sex and language in this movie, but it's all very real and realistic and not exploitative or gaudy or anything. It's just this, you know, a movie for adults by adults. And it's the kind of movie you want to see. And even if you don't love this movie, just the idea that you can, you know, make kind of one of these cheaper, quieter movies that deals with such big issues and can be, you know, very important to some people. And I'm just glad that movies like this are being made. And there's no one who does it better than Charlie Kaufman, I think.
Yeah, I think that's probably a fair statement.
And I feel like that's the way that another one of our Charlie Kaufman podcasts ends. So
yeah, probably.
That sounds like the ending to me.
I mean, most of his movies kind of end up in the same sort of place anyway, so it's only fair that our podcasts about them do as well.
True.
Resigned acceptance. So thanks for listening to The MacGuffin Man. Be sure to check back next week for our next episode.
Thanks for listening to The MacGuffin Men. Be sure to check out themacguffinmen.com for supplementary links, articles, and more. Thanks for listening.